Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's a Middle Eastern country that blends tradition and modernization and defies stereotypes. Linda Funch is a specialist in modern Middle East studies and Islamic history. She lectures about Oman, an Arab country in Western Asia at the mouth of the Persian Gulf. Get your map out, right? And Linda is also a professor of Middle East and Islamic studies at Frederick Community College in Maryland. And she's lecturing at SDSU in the Alumni Center tomorrow night from 7 until 9. The topic, Oman's role in promoting peace in the Middle East. And she is with us now in our SDPB Suval's studio. Linda Funch, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. It's a pleasure.
And I should say also author of the book Oman Reborn, Balancing Tradition and Modernization. Take me way back to the 1970s and the first time that you visited this country. Why were you there? And tell me what it was like, that first visit.
Well, I will preface it with the fact that, of course, I was very young at the time.
Right.
I was living and working in Beirut, Lebanon, for the Ford Foundation, and I had the opportunity to write a grant for to enable female Arab anthropologists to travel to Oman to help the government collect information so that they could formulate programs for women and children in education and healthcare. This came on the heels of the accession to the throne of Sultan Qaboos in 1970, who was bent on modernizing a very backward country.
So take me to the moment where you're there. What do you see as far as infrastructure, your first impressions of Oman?
Well, coming from Beirut, Lebanon, which at that time was the Paris of the Near East, the Switzerland of the Near East, Oman was like the other side of the moon. It was underdeveloped. It had, at that time, virtually no government infrastructure. In 1970, there were a total of 6 miles of paved road in the entire country, 3 primary schools only for boys, with a total enrollment of less than 1,000. And it was very much a hermit kingdom until the accession of Sultan Qaboos to the throne, who was determined to modernize his country in a meaningful way.
So I want to talk about that modernization and sort of that combination of maintaining an identity, but yet also picking the modernization that's going to be appropriate. But tell me about the Sultan at first. So how old is he about when he comes into power, and what drives this motivation to say, we have some place to go and I'm going to take us there?
His Majesty Sultan Qaboos was 29 years old at the time. He had a foot in both East and West, if you will, because, of course, he was a child of the Sultan of Oman, but he also did his advanced education in Europe. He was a graduate of Sandhurst Royal Military Academy in England. He served with the British Army in Germany, and he returned to Oman, to this extremely underdeveloped place, with a civil war raging in the south and a virtual insurrection in the north, and felt that something needed to be done. The made-for-film version of this story is that when he returned, his father essentially put him under house arrest for 6 years.
Wow.
And because he saw this force for change that was entering his realm. But during that time, Sultan Qaboos studied Omani history, Islam, the Quran. He became totally vested in his culture, which ultimately made him very well equipped to begin a modernization program, a culturally authentic modernization program.
All right, what does that look like? What is a culturally authentic? You have to know who you are.
You have to know who you are. You have to know where you have been. Oman is one of the oldest countries in the Middle East. In the Arabian Peninsula, only Oman and Yemen have actually been countries for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. They have a history. They have a glorious history They know where they've been, and they know what they are. And because of their sense of national identity, they don't need to be someone else. They don't need to be little mini Westerners. So their attempt to modernize was based on selective modernization. Take the technology that suits them to move their country forward into a new era, but remain true to roots. So, for example, what struck me about Oman after a visit of some 30 years after my initial visit was the fact that, unlike many of its neighbors in the Arabian Peninsula, there are no skyscrapers in Oman. Hmm. There are no postmodern glass and steel buildings. Omani architecture, even in brand new buildings, is true to Omani architecture as it's been for centuries. Yes, state-of-the-art with all of the gadgets and technologies, but the Omanis don't feel they need to prove anything.
Right.
And there's a sense, a compelling sense of self-confidence and optimism. As a friend of mine who's a former U.S. ambassador to Oman put it, Omanis are comfortable in their own skin.
And therefore, because they don't have to prove anything, they have preserved
they
so
have
much.
Preserved. And yes, and one of the themes that the Sultan invokes repeatedly is, we will move ahead, but we will never forget our past.
Is it that message? So much more than the message, but talk a little bit about the importance of that message from him to take a nation that was one place and really convince people that going forward is not only the right thing to do, but is a safe thing to do. How much of his personality is, the heart of my question is, how much of his personality really drove some of those innovations and modernizations?
That's a wonderful question. And in fact, his personality has driven much of it. He is very much a Renaissance man, given with regard to his own talents, but he's a wonderful communicator. And one of the first things he did when he took the throne in 1970 was to go around the country on these sort of meet and greet tours to listen to the people, to hear about their lot in life, their concerns, their priorities. And he did that yearly until very recently when his health started to decline. So he's very much in touch with the people. And he also has given his people a sense of empowerment, particularly the women in Omani society. From the very beginning, he said, women are 50% of the population, and unless we engage them in every aspect of national life, we will not succeed. And again, on many, many levels, he has exemplified what a strong force he is for women's empowerment.
So your first visit, you're looking at, women are not even in public education they're not going to school at this point.
Yeah.
Now, if you step off the plane and drive around the country, what does women's education look like?
Now, of course, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of schools throughout the country, several universities, both public and private. And women are generally comprised at least 50%. Of the enrollment in the universities. They routinely excel in their academic studies, I am told repeatedly by all university administrators. And so they are tremendously well equipped to take on the challenges of a modern age. But aside from education, women in Oman now, unlike, again, many of their sisters in the Gulf countries, you will find women engaged in almost every aspect of Omani public society, which is to say not only are they doctors and nurses and teachers and engineers, but they are baggage handlers, they are airline pilots, they are security officers, they are cashiers and hotel receptionists. You don't find that in many other countries in the oil-rich Persian Gulf.
Tell me a little bit about religion and the role of, you know, when we think of the Middle East and you're talking about overcoming some stereotypes, you think of sectarian violence. That's where your mind often goes. How has that situation been dealt with in Oman?
It has not been dealt with because it's not a situation. In Oman, most of the citizens of Oman are Muslim. But in Oman, there are three traditions of Islam that are followed. In the West, we hear about the Sunni and Shia and the Great Divide. But in Oman, most of the folks who follow the Islamic tradition are the third tradition within Islam, and they are called Ibadis. And most of the world's Ibadis are in Oman. And I can talk a bit about what distinguishes Ibadism from Sunni and Shia traditions. But suffice it to say that in Oman, there are the three traditions. I dare not even call them sects because they are really not. They are traditions, but they are not emphasized. And Sunni, Shia, Ibadi worship together, live together, intermarry, and it is not an issue. It is one of the very few countries in the region these days where sectarianism is simply not an issue.
Huh. Christian population?
There are many, many Christians, and there are many Hindus, because many of the expatriate laborers, both skilled and unskilled, come from South Asia. And if a Hindu community or a Christian community wish to build a place of worship, the Sultan will give them the land upon which to build that place of worship.
Tell me a little bit about, as you mentioned, expatriate workers, sort of that economic development, because the pace of growth surely must be something that they've, you know, had one of the challenges to be overcome would be to find the workers who are going to help build the nation into what it can be. A large influx of you know, temporary workers, immigrant workers? How do you characterize that in Oman?
Both, Lori. At the very beginning, of course, when the Sultan said, look, we've got to build a country from scratch. I mean, what an awesome challenge. Well, who is going to do that? One of the first things he did was to invite Omanis who were living in many other countries in East Africa, in the rest of the Middle East, and in Europe to come home. These are Omanis who were educated, had skills, and he invited them with open arms and in many cases even offered to match their salaries, just come back home and let's build this together. So many Omanis today, particularly in the highest levels of government, including, for example, the Omani ambassador to the United States, who is a woman who was born in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and her sister, also another Foreign Service officer, returned to Oman. But today, in addition to those individuals, Oman has needed to recruit expatriates from many, many other countries, not to the extent that some of its neighbors. You hear stories about Oman's neighbor to the north, for example, the United Arab Emirates, where between 90 and 95% of all of its workers are expatriates. In Oman, it's quite a bit less, perhaps 40 to 45%. And they are increasingly unskilled laborers who do construction work and roadways and that sort of thing, but less and less because there is a new program underway called Omanization, which is geared toward opening the door to Omanis for work in every sector of society, skilled and unskilled. And in fact, they are doing quotas. They have enacted quotas in some areas so that only Omanis or a certain percentage of Omanis must be working. Because while Oman does have oil reserves and oil production still represents its major financial asset, doesn't have quite a lot of oil, quite as much as its neighbors, and it's running out. It's a finite resource.
Right.
So part of its program going forward is to not only diversify its economy, but employ Omanis to replace the expatriates.
What is the current impact, the historical impact, or the potential impact then of Oman and some of the things we've discussed already on the rest of the region? Does it have an effect? Or are people looking, you know, are Middle Eastern countries looking to Oman as an example of how to build a nation that is at peace, that is economically viable? Help me through that a little bit, please.
In my opinion, and that of many others, Oman is really an exemplar of peace in the Middle East. It has an independent foreign policy. It is neutral. You will not find Omani boots on the ground in any country of the Middle East in any current conflict. It assists in mediation efforts. It likes to facilitate diplomatic initiatives and has done so and continues to do so. But Omani foreign policy is a pragmatic foreign policy, and it is one that believes very strongly on the value of mutual respect and dialogue. So Oman, for example, is a frequent interlocutor between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran. Oman has very cordial ties with both countries, particularly the United States, since the time of George Washington, in fact. But it does not believe that it has to choose one side or the other. It believes it can play a useful role in bringing peace among nations.
And has it done that throughout history? Are there examples of times when we could say, you know, that role that they have chosen to take was particularly effective at this time?
Well, we cannot point to anything before 1970, of course, because it was pretty much a hermit kingdom until Sultan Qaboos assumed the reins of power. But yes, I would say since he's come to power, there are many examples where Oman has stepped up to the plate. For example, in the Arab-Israeli conflict, after Camp David and the Egyptian-Israeli peace accords, Egypt was ostracized by virtually all other Arab states, with the exception of Somalia and Sudan. All the countries, with those exceptions, broke their diplomatic relations with Egypt, decided they had sold out to the Israelis. Oman did not. Oman went against the tide and embraced Egypt as a brother in a common pursuit, and was vindicated years later when all the other Arab states came around and once again welcomed Egypt into the fold. During that time, Oman has had trade relations with Israel. They've worked on a regional water desalination plans with Israel. They are independent and pragmatic.
Are there lessons when we talk about, you know, lessons and inspiration for, or you know, connections with their neighbors? How about for the United States when we look at how you know, Oman does foreign policy or you know, economic growth? What are some of the lessons that you would encourage, you know, Americans to look at and say, this is something that is, you know, perhaps takes a good close look on our end as well?
Yes. I must say that the principles that underlie Omani foreign policy and those that appear to underlie American foreign policy today are starkly different. The Omanis believe in dialogue, in diplomacy, in talking with people with whom you disagree. They believe in looking at a situation from another person's perspective or another party's perspective. They believe that military action should be the very last course, and they never rattled their sabers.
You mentioned the Sultan being in ill health or having health issues. Let's talk about his succession, this person who has meant so much. He must be incredibly popular amongst his people, although not perfect. I'm sure it goes without saying, but you know, what happens next? How is that succession laid out?
That's an excellent question, because Oman is such a good news story, and his will be a very difficult act to follow, to be sure. Sultan Qaboos has no children, so there is no heir apparent. However, there is a constitution in Oman called the Basic Law, and the constitution lays out the procedure for succession, which essentially states that after the throne becomes vacant, members of the royal family will gather and select a successor to the throne based on certain parameters, certain criteria. That individual has to be a member of the royal family, has to have both parents, Omani parents, and presumably the royal family will make a determination. If they do not, another governing council will meet and have the opportunity to open the envelopes which Sultan Qaboos has left in two secure places in Oman with the names of two people that he think would make good successors to the throne.
Fascinating. Linda Funch is the author of Oman Reborn, Balancing Tradition and Modernization. She joined us in the Sioux Falls studio today for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, but you can see her in Brookings tomorrow evening at 7 at SDSU's Alumni Center. Her lecture is called Oman's Role in Promoting Peace in the Middle East. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Lori. It was a great pleasure.